today on Against the Grain, what do animals have to do with absolutism? Can animal bodies and representations be used to justify authoritarian rule, or can they model forms of conduct expected of a ruler's associates? I'm C.S. A new book by Peter Sollens claims that animals played a key role in Louis XIV's absolutist regime in France. The UC Berkeley historian joins me, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Animals aren't just animals. In a world dominated by humans, animals are called upon, are enlisted to play certain roles, to act certain parts, even to fit within cultural frameworks of power and authority. Now, power, governmental power, comes in many flavors, but one form of it is authoritarian rule, and perhaps no ruler exemplified or embodied absolute authority better than Louis XIV of France. Louis XIV enjoyed the longest reign of any monarch of a major European country. He assumed the throne at the age of 5, in 1643, and his reign ended 72 years later, upon his death in 1715. While much has been written about absolutist rule and about Louis XIV, historian Peter Sollens has written a book that tells the story of the French monarch's reign through and with animals. Yes, animal bodies, animal representations, and animal symbolism. The animals he writes about in his book 1668, The Year of the Animal in France, those animals lived or were depicted in the Royal Gardens of Versailles, in which Louis XIV had constructed a menagerie or zoo, and also a labyrinth populated by elaborate fountains with sculpted animals in poses corresponding to a set of fables. Sollens argues in his book that the violent predatory nature of the sculpted animals in the labyrinth were meant to justify absolutist rule. Only a strong king could impose order in a world dominated by aggression and chaos. Sollens also argues that the graceful and peaceful demeanor of the animals that roamed the royal menagerie in Versailles furnished a model of civility to be emulated at the king's court. When Peter Sollens, a professor of history at UC Berkeley, joined me recently in studio, I asked him why he gave his book the title 1668.
Well, I think it was a bit of a joke, actually, although my publisher might think otherwise. It is a way of orientalizing France in a strange and unexpected way, and I wanted to do that in order to underscore the really unusual event or set of events that I'm identifying as having taken place in that year in 1668. You know, when I think of KPFA, I think of your audience, and I think maybe they might have preferred an earlier title, an earlier version of the book, which was called The Animal Revolution of 68. By that, I refer not to the conspiring and plotting of animals to revolt from the royal menagerie and to escape, and it's actually not as far-fetched an idea as might seem. There's much contemporary literature which makes a lot of the plotting of animals to escape from zoos in contemporary society. But I wasn't concerned with that, and nor was I concerned in a revolution in the treatment of animals along a humanitarian curve, which in truth doesn't really begin until the 18th century, until the Enlightenment. Rather, I was interested in this novel and really quite explosive use of animals by a rather small group, a coterie of courtiers, poets, and artists who took the live and dead animals that came from the king's newly constructed royal menagerie and transposed them into a wide variety of media, and resulting in a plethora of cultural products that allows me to identify this one year, 1668, as the year of the animal.
Well, to what extent has the year 1668 been identified and singled out as a significant year in terms of animals and animal symbolism in Louis XIV's France?
Well, it's an interesting question because the year 1668 has already been noticed in other contexts. It is the end of the War of the Devolution with Spain. It is the beginning of the marks the festivities of the king, the young King Louis XIV in the gardens of Versailles. It's also the year in which books of great renown found publication, including Jean de La Fontaine's Fables of 1668, which of course is about animals. But truth be told, the animals of 1668 have largely gone unnoticed, completely invisible. Of course, the menagerie, the royal zoo, from which many of these animals originated, had long been studied and has recently, in fact, been reconstructed in 3D representations by a team in France. But the uses of these animals, both as part of a display of animal spectatorship and also in the aftermath, when their bodies found themselves dissected and woven and literary stories were told about them and such, this convergent set of uses, often in dialogue with each other and sometimes conflicting with each other, has largely gone unnoticed. So I've been, in this book, making an effort not just to raise the attention of animals in 1668, but to try to explore further the particular uses to which they were put and the resulting effect of these animals in French politics, in ideas about governance, in ideas about nature, and in ideas about animals themselves.
Louis XIV, he decided to build the royal menagerie in late 1662, and you write the construction of it began in 1664. So this was in Versailles. Paint a picture. What are we talking about? And were the animals in the menagerie, were they for consumption or were they for observation and enjoyment?
Well, visitors who go to Versailles these days see the completed reconstruction of the gardens and parks, although the menagerie is in ruins. It's at the edge of the Great Canal and has never been excavated archaeologically. It had been destroyed in the French Revolution. But in 1664, when it was constructed, it was the first pavilion built in the vast, or soon to be vast, gardens of Versailles by Louis XIV as a statement of taking possession of the realm. And this was obviously a symbolic statement, and the parks and gardens of Versailles served as a metaphor of the kingdom. And the king's management of the site, including the building of the menagerie, serves as a kind of microcosm for us to understand the eventual structure and working of the institution of absolutism that he, in fact, represents in his long reign. So the animals of the menagerie began to arrive early in 1666, as I describe in the book, and they came commissioned by the king's superintendent of buildings, Colbert, and they were also presented as gifts, such as the elephant from the Portuguese ambassador in 1668. And gradually, a population of animals collected around this new viewing pavilion built by Louis Laveau in 1664. By 1668, that collection was complete. And like a traditional menagerie, it was destined in part to supply foodstuffs for the king's table. But many of them came as exotics, which really referred more to distance and geography than to anything else. And they came and were used for display purposes only, if we might say. And these animals included, for the most part, birds, swans, crane, heron, peacocks, but also larger cassowaries, ostrich, flamingos, storks, and so forth. And it's these graceful cranes, many of them from southern parts of the African continent, others from the New World, and either parts of Eurasia, these from all over, but not in any systematic way, came this collection of birds, of wondrous, graceful, peaceful, and beautiful birds. And these birds became the symbols, not just of Louis XIV's new reign, but also of the courtiers, both male and female, that accompanied the king.
So in other words, the birds in the menagerie, you are saying, were chosen specifically for their grace and their peaceful nature and their beauty as a conscious effort by the king to present a kind of model of his court and of how Versailles operated?
I think that's right, although as an historian, I would shy away from the word conscious because we're never certain without any particular textual evidence where this idea might have come from or how it might actually have worked. But certainly, the animals served as a model of the new absolutist reign. And what's interesting, at least for me, in thinking about how this model was constructed, is to imagine how Louis XIV actually took possession not just of the kingdom in these years, but also of a certain literary culture and style that was in vogue in the decade preceding the construction of the menagerie, which was a cultural style that privileged birds and animals as speaking, conscious, cognizant beings, but also emotional, suffering, and passionate ones. Part of this is captured in the literary movement that we know of as preciosity, and part of it is evidenced in what we see as a surge of pet keeping among the aristocracy and the bourgeoisie in urban as well as rural settings. Louis XIV is long known to historians and readers of popular history as a lover of animals, a great lover of animals. Mostly, historians point out through his obsession, like that of many French kings, with the hunt and with all the attendant animals that are both companions and victims in that long and elaborate but daily ritual event. Louis XIV was also a great pet keeper, and dogs in particular, including but not exclusively his hunting dogs, were the recipients of his kindness and largesse. And in some ways, the construction of the menagerie must have been part of Louis XIV's personal engagement with the animal world. But in another sense, this is a broader social and cultural phenomenon, because he borrowed in constructing the menagerie from the practices, the beliefs, but also the poetry itself of Parisian literary culture in the 1650s and 1660s, in particular a literary and cultural movement known as preciosity, which privileged speaking beasts and their passionate love lives as a subject of literary endeavors. So this borrowing was more than the personal taste of the king. It was an actual cultural transfer of attitudes and beliefs and norms about animals and their representations into Versailles, and in the context, the ability of Louis XIV to make use of these attitudes and beliefs in constructing, in fact, a new model of absolutism. And what's important about the talking birds with their back-bending gaits and their peaceable characteristics is not so much their individual identities or their identities as species, but the fact that these birds were chosen by Louis XIV, and I use that word loosely because, again, the collection was itself the result of contingency and accident. At the same time, the framework was imposed, and the birds in that sense were chosen over a different kind of animal that dominated courtly cultures in the early modern period, that is, the wild and predatory animals of lions and tigers and panthers and bears.
Peter Salins, history professor at UC Berkeley. Again, his book is 1668, The Year of the Animal in France. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Yeah, speaking of this contrast with a kind of savage, wild beasts, can you talk about the contrast between the menagerie and certain gardens in Vincennes that were built at the behest of Louis XIV?
Certainly, and I think the word key word here is in part behest, because Louis XIV did not actually assume personal possession of the kingdom, that is, rule without a prime minister, until he made that declaration in 1661 at the age of 23. So in the decade preceding, as a teenager, he was under the tutelage of Cardinal Mazarin, who was actually from Florence and an Italian, and perhaps the Queen's lover, and who had himself ideas about the uses of animals in display, borrowed from the Florentine tradition. The Florentine tradition itself was invented in the Renaissance as a pale imitation of the great Roman venationes, the great massive killing of wild animals that took place in the Colosseum. But the idea of building an arena for animal combat was very much part of a Florentine and Italian tradition. Now, what's interesting about this is that this was constructed in the late 1650s, and it was finally completed for the first animal combats in 1663. But Louis XIV in 1661 had already taken possession of the kingdom. Cardinal Mazarin had died. His son was born, so an heir was assured. He had declared his intentions to turn his father's old hunting lodge into a palace and gardens, the likes of which Europe had never seen. And so he turned his back on these few animal combats that took place in 1663, and with it shifted an entire orientation, tipping France, as it were, away from the Mediterranean and Italy towards the Atlantic and Northern Europe. So here's an example of how I use animals to talk about major geopolitical and cultural shifts that took place in the course of 17th century Europe.
Well, speaking of shifts, you also write in your book about the labyrinth, the royal labyrinth in the gardens of Versailles. So this was a separate area, as I understand it, from the menagerie. It was completed in 1674, so years later, a number of years later than the menagerie was completed and opened. And it featured fountain sculptures. And many of these sculptures, or maybe you can tell me all of them, were of animal figures. So what kinds of animals were represented in the labyrinth, were chosen for the labyrinth?
So the labyrinth was actually planted in the same year that the menagerie was built, in 1664, the elaborate hedges, but it was an unusual set of mazes or maze built on a 7-acre lot in the so-called small park quite close to the palace. It was unusual because labyrinth gardens in gardens had been common practice among Renaissance monarchs well into the 17th century, but they tended to be more and more symmetrical and often made of low mazes. And nobody had thought to actually populate a labyrinth of any kind, whether with a single entrance or a complex one, with animal figures, and in particular with animal figures drawn from Aesop. So this is the key for the construction of the labyrinth in 1672 and 1674. That is, the construction means the population of the labyrinth with figures of animals in relation to each other in fountain settings drawn from Aesop. Aesop, of course, was a la mode in 17th century France, but particularly after 1668, after Jean de La Fontaine, chose to rewrite Aesop in his own version of the fables, published that very year. But he wasn't alone. There were imitators. And much demand in French and Parisian literary culture for the genre of the fable.
What were the lessons of the animal fables in the fountain sculptures of the Labyrinth?
So the Labyrinth has puzzled historians, art historians, garden historians, labyrinth historians for centuries. What is the meaning of the Labyrinth? And in fact, what I try to show in the book is that, like the fable itself, there is no stable, uncontested, coherent meaning, and certainly not one that can be found in every sculptural figuration, every sculptural installation of the Labyrinth. So in these 39 sculptures, however, there is a tendency to portray a kind of animal violence that precisely had been eliminated from the representation of animals in the menagerie. In other words, animal violence, the condition of predation, returns to the gardens of Versailles, but this time as sculpted, ornamental decorations in a garden maze that serve the purpose for much of the aristocratic visitors who went there, as well as the audience that read the printed descriptions and accounts of the Labyrinth and could play the game from home. The lessons for these aristocrats were varied in many. For Louis XIV, I surmise, the lessons were a little bit different. One of the striking characteristics of the Labyrinth in the garden is it is the only place where the sun doesn't actually shine. The long, tall hedges, usually planted of ash, beech, or other fast-growing trees, were such that descriptions already, 10 years after it was built, describe a place in shadow. And for me, the symbolic contrast between light and dark, between sun and shadow, is a key for interpreting the royal or official version of the meaning of this labyrinth.
What did the darkness of the labyrinth and, as you said, sort of the violent predatory nature of the animals represented in the labyrinth, what was that meant to say or communicate about human nature and about how humans acted?
I think it's important to remember that we're talking about the Sun King, that is, a monarch who has chosen as his personal device the sun. In this context, the shadows of the labyrinth take on new and significant meaning. Since this is the one place where the sun does not shine, it's the one place where the authority of the king does not penetrate. And where the authority of the king is absent, so the fable of the labyrinth tells us, human nature becomes violent and uncontrolled. The passions are disruptive. They can be held in check by strong authority, but left in darkness on their own, it is a world more recognizable to Hobbes, perhaps, than to Jean de La Fontaine, a world of predatory instinct, of man eat man, of ultimate destruction. Louis XIV showed the way out of the labyrinth in a series of garden maps that he produced in the 1680s. And the key to the experience of the labyrinth, I believe, was precisely to escape from it, to leave it behind into the sun-filled gardens with their perspectives onto infinity, away from the dark and tortured path that descended into the baseness of human nature.
That's Peter Sollens. He is professor of history at UC Berkeley and the author of, among other books, 1668, The Year of the Animal in France, which examines the importance of animals and animal symbolism in the formative years of Louis XIV's absolutist regime in France. We'll take a short break and speak more with Peter about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Peter Sollins is my guest in studio. He teaches history at UC Berkeley. And his book, 1668, The Year of the Animal in France, looks at how animals and animal spectatorship and animal representations relate to authoritarian government, and specifically, in Peter's case, to the style of absolutism practiced by King Louis XIV in France. Give us some more detail about some of the sculpted animal figures in the fountains in the Royal Labyrinth of Versailles.
Right. So, unfortunately, we only have a few fragments of these sculptures that have survived the ravages of the centuries. But even these fragments tend to show animals, and I reproduce one or two in the book, in positions of either predation or fear. The surviving visual evidence of the labyrinth gives us quite detailed images of the 39 separate fountains and the staging of different fables drawn from the Aesopian corpus and from elsewhere, I might add. What's curious and ironic about the animals of the labyrinth is that many of them are actually drawn from either images of the animals of the Royal Menagerie or animals of the Royal Menagerie themselves. That is, the artists, and we don't know the overall architect or designer of these fountains, but we do know the individual artists who were responsible for them. The artists frequently went to the Menagerie for models, or they used the drawings of a Flemish artist who had been employed at the Gobelin manufactory to draw animals that would serve in the decorative arts of Louis XIV. So when these animals were drawn, they were often drawn in peaceful poses or posed together in ways that did not suggest the predation and violence. And the transformation of the artist sculptors who created the installations in the labyrinth was to turn these peaceful and docile creatures into ferocious and predatory animals, including the birds. And in fact, although mammals tend to dominate in the labyrinth, we do have a striking set of examples of birds, not graceful cranes or even storks, although they appear in the Aesopian fountains of the labyrinth, but rather angry, predatory, violent, and hungry ones that are posed with water streaming from their beaks in elaborate montage that represents a scene of violence and encounter. And this theme can be found in many of the fountains, but it's really central to the two core fountains of the labyrinth, the one at the entrance, which is a story of avian violence, of birds that beat up on a horned owl, and the one that's nearest, as proximate as possible, the center of the labyrinth, which is called quite openly the combat of the animals, and involves, in fact, an elaborate staging of a struggle between mammals on the one hand and birds on the other.
There is a bat depicted in that second fountain. What is that bat doing, and what parallel might you draw, or did you draw in this book, between the bat and the horned owl that is under attack in the first fountain?
Well, I was thinking about these creatures, and I realized that they were actually anomalous in some ways. They were really, from an anthropologist's perspective, they were kind of misclassified, because in particular the bat is a creature that only flies at night. The horned owl, too, makes its presence only when the sun is absent. So these two central figures in the labyrinth are speaking as well symbolically to the visual symbolism of Louis XIV as Sun King. They're animals that come out only when the sun is absent. And that reinforces the more general message of the labyrinth, the more general meaning of the fable of the labyrinth, at least from the royal perspective, which is that this kind of violence will only intensify in the absence of strong rulership.
Violence among animals or violence among humans? I mean, was the parallel made, or are you making that parallel?
Well, the parallel is implicit in the idea of the fable, certainly in the 17th century. And La Fontaine, in his preface to his Fables of 1668, made the proclamation that he uses animals in order to understand man. Of course, man being understood in the 17th century term. So the logic of the fable was such that it was intended to display a set of human characteristics within animals and a set of human behaviors among animals. Now, it turns out that in Aesop's case, this was not particularly grounded in the bird-eat-bird world of predation and flight, although a number of Aesopian fables from the corpus put together in the second century, and a number of La Fontaine's fables do make this kind of claim. But it was particularly strongly stated in the Royal Labyrinth and the statues that were commissioned, the fountain statues that were commissioned in 1674. And I read the Royal Labyrinth as very much a kind of fable of absolutism itself, in which the absence of strong royal authority unleashes the predatory nature of his subjects.
Were there any symbols of kingship or royalty placed in the labyrinth?
I've been waiting for a question on the Lion King, because most people tend to identify, as they have for centuries, the lion as a formidable symbol of strong kingship. The lion is completely absent in the labyrinth, although he's a star of the bestiary of La Fontaine in 1668. And that was a puzzling question for me, and I began to look at the iconography of Louis XIV himself and to note that lionine imagery was very weakly linked with this particular king, and indeed with all French kings. And that has to do with the fact that subsequent dynasties of French monarchs had no strong claim to the lion as an emblem of authority, in part because too many of France's neighbors had already made use of that emblem in symbolically more significant ways so as to gain possession of it. I speak of Spain, of course, but also of England, and even more proximately, the Netherlands, of which the lion was the iconic animal. So France had no strong claim to the lion. Still, one might have imagined Louis XIV making an effort, but no, he chose another animal to emblematize, to symbolize both himself and the kingdom, an animal with an unusual emblematic history that goes back to the Middle Ages. It's the rooster. Now, the rooster, the French rooster, started as an insult hurled by the English at the end of the Hundred Years' War in the 15th century. But slowly it became adopted within the visual iconography of French kings to the point where under Henry IV at the beginning of the 17th century, with his famous declaration that preceded by 327 years or something like that, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's idea of putting a chicken in every pot on Sunday. Louis XIV was purported to have made the same promise. The chicken became symbolic of the French people. Now, this is a difficult story to reconstruct, but I did spend a lot of time trying to understand why Louis XIV, at the beginning of his reign, would try to recapture the emblem of the French people as a sign or symbol of royalty. And then it struck me, the apocryphal phrase that was never uttered by Louis XIV, but ought to have been, that the state is me, was here being replicated through the manipulation of animals as symbols. Louis XIV became a rooster, as encompassing and incorporating the people that he governed. Now, that's not such a far-fetched idea. It's true that certain literary critics, one in particular, have pointed out that when he dressed up the king, Louis XIV, for the great carousel of 1662, he actually dressed up as a rooster, not as a Roman general. The pictures are ambiguous, but they could suggest that he was, in fact, costumed in a way to evoke a particular animal's identity. That's certainly not proof enough for an historian to work with. What becomes more evident is both in a series of more popular engravings that were circulated and in the establishment of an official French architectural order that included the rooster with its spread wings. And if you go to Versailles and you look up in the great hall of mirrors to the very top, you'll see 230 columns, each decorated by a small rooster.
Peter Sollens, professor of history at UC Berkeley. And again, we're talking about his book, 1668, The Year of the Animal in France. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And you write in your book that roosters were present in the labyrinth, but as unruly and angry beings, not sovereigns. They symbolized an animality rather than a regal presence. What about the temptation some people have, many people have, to disobey the king, to not obey the order, the central authority, the authoritarian government? What kind of moralized landscape did the labyrinth represent in the sense of either encouraging or discouraging disobedience?
Well, certainly the theme of disobedience is central to the garden architecture of Versailles, both within the labyrinth and beyond it. In fact, art historians and other scholars have spent many years arguing about whether central fountains or groves in Versailles can be read as transpositions of stories about Louis XIV's own childhood and his encounter with rebellious and disobedient subjects. In particular, the Fountain of Latona is often thought to represent that great mid-century rebellion in France known as the Fronde, led by the nobles, which resulted at one moment in Louis XIV being chased out of the city of Paris in a condition of fear. I'm not a big fan of reading the particular fountains or reading the labyrinth as expressing any particular episode in the life history of Louis XIV. But I do agree with those critics who have seen throughout the gardens evidence of moralizing stories about the costs of disobedience. Now, of course, it's very hard to be disobedient at the court of Louis XIV. One is just simply dismissed in doing so. So disobedience in that sense requires careful strategizing and subtle and intelligent ways of pushing back against royal authority. Perhaps the person that we know best in this context is the author of the Fables of 1668, La Fontaine. And I spend time with La Fontaine when he visits the menagerie, the King's Royal Zoo, in 1668 and describes it as part of a larger work. And when describing the birds of the menagerie, he shares the sense of his time, of their beauty and of their grace. But he also inserts criticism into his description of the gardens. And the most obvious, at least once one figures it out, and at least the most obvious instance is when he spends several lines praising a particular animal for its beauty and its docility and calls it a cormorant. It's clear from the description that he's describing a pelican. Now, the difference between a pelican and a cormorant may seem insignificant to us today. They're just two different species of birds. But in the 17th century, and I would argue today if we think hard and long about it, they're actually identified in different ways with good and evil, and indeed with damnation and salvation. The cormorant is an evil bird. The pelican is a sacred one that protects its young. For La Fontaine to go on at length describing the beauty of this bird and to call it a cormorant, I would argue, is like, and I say this in the book with some embarrassment, but only because it rings true, is like a turd in the garden, a form of resistance, of pushing back against all the efforts of Louis XIV to symbolize his greatness and his glory. Now, unfortunately, we don't have many examples of this, and certainly not in the labyrinth. We don't have any accounts that would suggest this kind of resistance. But the instability of the fable as a genre lends itself to the possibility of a reading which is resistant to a dominant authority or indeed a dominant narrative. It's in the nature of the fable. It's my colleague Leslie Kirk has written a book about this. It's in the nature of Aesop as a figure who was a slave, as far as we know. So while the fable can be used by the king to assert the importance of royal authority in order to control the passion of its subjects, it can also be read simultaneously, the same fable, as a form of resistance to the possibility of the full imposition of royal authority on the king's subjects.
So, Peter, what do you make of the fact that after 1674, visitors to the royal garden at Versailles would first visit the labyrinth and then end their visit in the menagerie?
Well, again, I think of the menagerie and of the labyrinth as the two pendants of this book, which represent in many ways two different models of royal absolutism. So the book, although focused on a single year, 1668, is really about a decade-long transformation that has to do with Louis XIV trying one version of absolutism, which I toss off as version 1.0 in the menagerie, and then resolving its contradictions over the course of 10 years, ending with the construction of the royal labyrinth, which I understand to be a more finalized version of Louis XIV's rule in 1674. So again, it's a book about a year, but it's really a book about a decade in that sense. And it's a book about a young man, a young king at the age of 23, who tries out, as it were, one version of what it means to be a new kind of king, ruling without a first minister. And one of the ways that he tries this out is with animals. In other words, animals serve as part of the language that's used to justify this new model of sovereignty, of absolutism. So the argument of the book, in looking at the transformation from the menagerie to the labyrinth, is that this story, while it's been told or mentioned before by others, is really best recounted with animals, because it really was with the bodies and representations of the animals of the menagerie that much of the model, either version 1.0 or 2.0 in 1674, was constructed.
Peter Salins is his name. He teaches history at UC Berkeley. His books include Unnaturally French, Foreign Citizens in the Old Regime and After, Forest Rights, R-I-T-E-S, The War of the Demoiselles in 19th Century France, and Boundaries, The Making of France and Spain in the Pyrenees. And his new book out from Zone Books is called 1668, The Year of the Animal in France. The book, again, examines the centrality of animals in the early years of Louis XIV's absolutist regime in France. Louis XIV was born in 1638, assumed the throne at the age of five in 1643, but he assumed personal rule without a first minister in 1661. And does that surprise you that animals would play such a significant role in the way a ruler like Louis XIV would either rule or would attempt to represent his rule, represent his sovereignty?
Not only does it surprise me, but I, having written the book, I still can't believe it. In the sense that, again, I'm seeking to make a contribution in this book to two very big questions that scholars ask of the 17th century. One is about the rise of strong centralized states, which we call absolutist states, and the paragon of this kind of rulership, of this kind of governance, is Louis XIV, who takes control, personal control, in 1661 and reigns until 1715. But the other problem, which is central to this book, which I'm trying to interrogate in a new way, is an aspect of what we used to call the scientific revolution. Now, there's an author who wrote a book with a very famous opening line in the preface that there was no such thing as the scientific revolution, and this is a book about it. And I take this very much to heart in the way that I think about the scientific revolution, because there was no such thing in the sense of a single year, a single thinker, or a single theory that can stand in for a whole set of transformations of culture and of ideas about nature that go from the 16th to the 18th century. Nonetheless, the central figure in the 17th century, the ideologue and philosopher of the scientific revolution, in France at least, is René Descartes. So the two figures that dominate this book are Louis XIV on the one hand, and René Descartes on the other. And of course, they're not contemporaries. Descartes dies in 1650. But at the same time, the importance of Descartes, not just in French thought, but in French politics and in French cultural life, really only begins almost 20 years after he dies in 1668. That is, after all, the year, at least June 1667, when his body is repatriated from Sweden and enshrined in a small church in the Latin Quarter of Paris. It's the year when many of his works are published for the first time, and it's the year when much of France and Europe begins to debate in public the idea of the beast machine, that is, the notion of animal automism. So I take these two figures, Louis XIV and René Descartes, and I tell the story of absolutism and the scientific revolution in the 17th century, but I tell it with animals. And I believe that, in fact, it's possible to say something more and indeed different about both absolutism and the scientific revolution, or the idea of mechanism to which it gives birth, using animals.
And to get back to my earlier question, what about the fact that visitors first went to the labyrinth and then to the menagerie? What about that fact interests you?
Well, of course, we don't have good hard evidence in the sense of textual descriptions or memoirs or diaries of people's experience first in the labyrinth and then in the menagerie. In pointing to the violence and the predation that is modeled in the labyrinth and that constitutes, in this sense, part of the fable of absolutism, I had to remind myself that that wasn't the whole story. If it was, French absolutism would simply be a Hobbesian universe in which a strong king intervenes in the violence and predation of the human condition. But it's more than that. And I think that the movement of spectators, of those undertaking this garden promenade, from the labyrinth ending with the menagerie, is a reminder of a distinctly French form of absolutism. Because the menagerie, as a holdover from Louis XIV's first version of absolutism built in the gardens of Versailles, continues to put forth the message of animals as participating in what I call in this book, following the German sociologist Norbert Elias, the civilizing process. Their grace, their beauty, their gestures, the backbending legs, the gait of storks and such, are all understood and configured as part of a process that banishes violence, that pushes predation, and that excludes rebellion from the scene. So visitors moving from the labyrinth to the menagerie start with a message of the baseness of human condition, but also its destructive and violent and predatory nature, and end with the admiration of these graceful avian creatures who model for them the proper behavior of a courtier at the court of Louis XIV.
Peter Sollens is his name, professor of history at UC Berkeley. Again, we've been talking about his new book, a very unusual and extraordinary book. It's called 1668, The Year of the Animal in France. Peter, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a wonderful opportunity.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.